Are you ready?
We're going to put God on trial.
If you think you're smarter than me, Wheaton, in that classroom, there is a God, and I'm him.
This experiment is over. You get to decide who the most important person in your life is. Me, Professor Ravison.
I have to do this thing. Like it's something that God wants me to do. I can't just turn away from it.
You just want to ensnare them in your primitive superstition.
What I want is for them to make their own choice. That's what God wants.
You have no idea how much I'm going to enjoy failing you.
Yeah, but who are you really looking to fail? Me or God?
Houston, we have a problem.
Hello and welcome. Today is Wednesday, the 11th of September, 2013, and you're listening to The Pseudoscientists, the official podcast of the Young Australian Skeptics. My name's Jack Scanlon, and joining me this week is Sarah McBride.
Hello, everyone.
Returning past host Alistair Tate.
Hello, everybody.
And special in the flesh proper guest this time, Kylie Sturgis.
Awesome. Hello, everyone. Great to meet you.
We had you recently on the show, but you were in Perth. And now you're in the actual studio.
I know, and this was a complete and utter treat and completely surprising that you got me here. I said I could sit out in the hallway and just wave and make faces and just be so happy that I got to see what this looks like. But now I'm actually in here and it's a bit overwhelming because it's so cool.
Yeah, it's rare that we have two guests on, but, you know, you can't resist the opportunity when it comes up.
It's certainly a step up from what we used to do in the beginning.
Yeah, well, you haven't been in this studio before, Alistair.
No, I haven't.
Last time you were on the show, I think it was around episode 50, around there, or 55, 54 or something, we were recording at a house that Belinda was sort of house sitting, still with our old equipment.
I remember that equipment.
I remember envying that equipment. I still have the same bloomin' equipment that I had back when, and I still have a cat who throws a temper tantrum unless she's allowed into my office in order to take part in the podcast. You have no cat, so I have that over you guys.
We have a spiritual cat that overlooks us all. So, yeah, our two guests have actually done a lot of interesting things recently. You know, Alistair went to the US and went to NASA. And Kylie was in New Zealand doing skeptic-y things, which is cool.
Yeah.
But there's something that, you know, we probably shouldn't talk about. We're going to anyway. Last episode, we mentioned the Australian politics stuff that was happening. And
I believe it's now called an election, Jack.
Well, if you want to get technical. And things happened. And we expressed, or I expressed, me and Upley, who were on last week, our displeasure at the potential result, and that result happened. So we have a terrible government for probably 3 years, unless they get booted out earlier than then, which may happen. Yeah, well, I think we'll touch on it a bit later with our question for next week.
We're going to have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, but it's not a good thing. It's a bit depressing. So, and it's not really related to science that much. I guess there's always the climate change angle of the fact that we're basically going to be doing nothing as a nation from now on.
Well, there's a lot of actual science consequences.
In terms of research, I believe.
Research redirection and stuff like that.
Yeah, we'll touch on that probably a little bit at the end. But oh, dear. Well, I think we should probably, because I think, Alistair, we're going to be talking about, you've done a lot of interesting science stuff. And we'll talk about that as like more of a news item thing, like a bulky thing. But Kylie, you have done very interesting things in New Zealand. You're basically in Melbourne because you're here via New Zealand in a weird sense.
Yes, yes. Whenever I have the opportunity, I try to stop off in Melbourne on the way home. And so I managed to give myself a day or so to get over the jet lag and then hop back home in order to continue my studies. But I was at the New Zealand Skeptics Conference and I had a wonderful time there. I wasn't the only Australian. Loretta Marin, who's famous for being formerly the Jelly Bean Lady and her amazing work that she's done in terms of promoting awareness and combating pseudoscience, particularly those involving health claims. And now she's working for Friends of Science and Medicine, which is a very forthright and proactive group that are trying to encourage getting less pseudoscience in universities. In addition to that, I had the opportunity to see Pamela Gay, who is, of course, awesome. She's going to be turning up over at Inbigham Books. I also had an opportunity to hear lots of New Zealand speakers as well. Dr. Susie Wiles, who does research into fireflies, and she's got videos online and has been doing a lot of science work in New Zealand. She's become a great spokeswoman. She has this amazing, bright, hot pink hair, and people now recognise her in the streets as the science lady, which is just so cool. Elf Elvidge, who talked about education and science in New Zealand and how they need to start networking more with projects. Amy Whitcroft, who talked about opportunities opportunities for nerd nights and getting people together to enjoy science and network with each other in more informal situations, Matt McCrudden on psychology, and of course Vicky Hyde, who is the former head of the New Zealand Skeptics. Now it's a great guy called Gold. She talked about all the work that the New Zealand Skeptics have done. The best thing, however, was the opportunity to see a psychic perform. Her name was Sue Nicholson. Now, she said that she had solved one particular murder, and there's a video that I'll be able to give you a link to where she names the person. I was trying to take notes all the way through in order to see how many people that she supposedly found by turning up in this show called Sensing Murder. And she did come up with one direct name, so I'm going to see if I can find out a bit more about it. But, yeah, we were very polite, and she essentially gave a talk about her background. I kind of found her experiences rather sad and thought she seemed rather alienated from the world. But what intrigued me was that at least two people in the audience, including Dr. Pamela Gay, were questioning her, and we could find so many commonalities in our life experiences, and yet she seemed to have just gone a completely different way and said that, you know, the world of reading and science and investigating in more formal ways that we might expect just didn't appeal to her. And she found the world of, you know, psychics and reading, doing readings for people was what she wanted to do, and this is what became her life. And I asked her if, you know, was she ever scared of murderers wanting to chase her down because, you know, she would supposedly know where the bodies are and, you know, who actually did it. And she said, yes, that she was fearful of these kinds of things. And I was wondering, you know, well, why don't you stop then? Because, you know, but no, well, she's on television. She's famous. They had a television crew. However, thankfully, the television crew that did film her took a slightly more sceptical bent than usual. Some people weren't interested. I know at least one other participant walked out rather than hear her talk. But I welcomed the opportunity to do a bit of a Q&A where I wasn't hiding in the audience and pretending to be an audience member who believed it.
Or walking the classic
up,
scenario.
Yeah, or walking up and getting a reading as I've done in the past and sort of, you know, trying to figure out how much cold reading and how much hot reading they were doing off me. This was an opportunity to go, yes, I am a skeptic and I have these questions about you and I want to hear about what makes you choose a different path to me. And I thought that was really cool, the New Zealand Skeptics, to do that.
Do you think she was legitimate? Like, do you think she believed it or do you...
I think she did. Now, I know that some people might think differently, but I thought she honestly did. I was under the impression, in my opinion, that she was extremely alienated from the world and this gave her a sense of belonging. One other question I did ask her was, do other psychics interact with each other? You know, do you get together and have psychic parties and have a rave?
That'd be awesome.
You know, the psychic nightclub down rave, the road, yeah. You know, you'll know the
rave
password
with the
to get
undead.
In. Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah.
I hope somebody has a UV aura.
Yeah. Well, you know, do you get together and you know, chat and be friends and stuff like that? And she said, no, apparently they don't. The psychics generally don't network with, you know, they don't get together like we do and have podcasts or whatnot, or, hey, dudes, let's go out and have dumplings or anything like that. Apparently,
you think
really,
it'd be, you think it'd be
like
pretty
that.
Easy to, you know, just get in touch with each other. After all,
yeah, I don't know. All these little stereotypes popped into my mind, but apparently it's not like that. Apparently they're very distant from each other, and I thought, oh, that's a bit sad because, if it was true, it would be awesome to know that you weren't alone in the world. And if psychic powers weren't true, I guess it sort of means that there's a nasty bit of competitiveness going on.
I'm surprised that nobody has sort of made a real life Hogwarts for psychics.
Yeah, like a training program for psychics.
Or like a Professor X, a college for mutants and stuff.
I'm certain there must be one out there.
I'm surprised there's
like
a university degree.
Yeah.
And there's university degree for other alternative
Yeah, but that things. Tends not to be like a personal internal skill.
Well, we'll define Reiki.
I don't know. Do I have to?
No, you can do courses in Reiki.
Yeah, I know. Apparently. But that's more of a, you know, everybody has healing
everybody
energy.
Everybody has the potential.
Rather than you're the gifted person with
can
the
you
force.
Do them, can you do those courses without actually going?
Without actually going?
Yeah,
you just become good at Reiki.
He gets it.
Remote sensing, viewing.
Yes.
Well, you don't have to go to the lecture, you just, you know.
Well, in terms of courses, they used to have the Pear Institute and parapsychology back in the 70s, which was sort of like, you know, testing psychic powers, but I don't know if they were actually training people to do it.
Yeah, we need like a Jedi Academy for psychics. That'd be good.
You know, back in the 70s, it was probably a reasonable idea to just double check that, you know, there isn't any sort of psychic stuff. But like now it's like pretty conclusive. No,
maybe it's conclusive that the people that have been tested don't have it, but there's always the potential that someone maybe has it in the future. Mm. But that's all biased by our own cultural perceptions. So if everybody, or cultural sort of ideas, so if everybody that claims they're a psychic now isn't a psychic, why should we expect that somebody who is like what people have said should, like, actually exist?
Basically,
so it's like, you know, if all alien abductions or like sightings of aliens are false and they don't actually exist, then why should we expect that if aliens do exist, they should appear
conform
or be like
that.
What we assume aliens are like?
Yeah, conform to the
maybe psychic powers are not like that at all. Maybe like real psychic power is like talking to trees or something. I don't know. Something that nobody's thought of.
Well, it always makes for good science fiction novels. I mean, I always enjoyed Firestarter by Stephen King. The notion of being able to burst things into flame with your mind. It seemed like a terrifying concept, and that intrigued me. But yeah,
or like being able to drive cars and only cars with your mind.
Or what is it in Looper, like the only psychic ability people have is to like just teleport tiny coins.
PK or something. It's like very
but anyway, the conference was awesome. I was really glad to be invited, and I'm certainly going to recommend that the Pseudoscientist podcast maybe might be able to make the next one, because I think
if they want to pay,
I think they should.
Oh, you know, I think we could make a.
I think it'd be good.
An effort, perhaps.
To raise money? I don't have enough money for that.
Well, maybe
people can donate, but that'll be in the future.
I shall be very encouraging of it, because one of the awesome things about this event was that it had a very high ratio of women to men on the stage, and it was just by sheer accident. And for me, it demonstrated that diversity and attempting to get in new voices and so on, and certainly younger voices, was a focus. It's just sort of a implied focus that just naturally occurred, and for me, that was just wonderful. So big, huge thanks to the New Zealand Skeptics for that.
Awesome. Well, it's great to hear what's been happening over there.
Yeah.
I think we should, before we get onto news, talk about the Houston clip, and I think this is probably my favourite Houston clip that we've ever done. And, you know, I didn't play the entire thing at the start of the show because that would have been too long. It is a movie trailer, if you didn't realise, for a movie called God's Not Dead. You can probably guess from the clip that we played, it's quite a... Well, you probably can't guess that it's a high-budget Christian film, but you could probably guess that it is a Christian film.
You should definitely go watch the trailer, because it's surprisingly well made, but it's just really funny.
High production values.
It's got the most angry stereotype philosophy atheists ever.
As a high school teacher of philosophy and as a university teacher of philosophy, I couldn't find it funny. Everyone else was going... I just felt really insulted and upset, because I usually play the devil's advocate when it comes to atheist topics. I'll end up with the class sort of saying, oh, yeah, but Nietzsche's right. And I said, well, how do we know? Come on, defend yourself. Because I want to know, because I see a lot of arguments out there for the existence of God, and I want you to see if you can work your way through them. And, yeah, it just made me very upset to see
this.
This
guy was Kevin Sorbo, the guy who plays the, for those who don't remember, Hercules. He's now playing this angry professor. He was, like, one step away from eating babies in this trailer. Like, he was really angry, and I couldn't help but thinking if he was actually in a real university, he would be struggling to maintain his tenure. Like, he would be, like, he would be, like, being told to reel it in.
It's ridiculous and very entertaining. I remember one of the old Houston clips that we did was some Christian film about Christmas and how, like they didn't want the...
It was
Christmas
very much
with the
like
sea.
That.
Yes.
That's, that it's also in that vein.
It was, and that was kind of like the atheist who stole Christmas. It was like atheist coming to town, telling everyone, take down all your Christmas decorations.
Happy holidays, what's this?
Yeah, but if you watch it, it's actually got a nice sort of inclusive message in it, in terms of, you know...
To quote
Phil Plait, don't be a dick. It was more about, you know, hey, dude, just don't do that. You know, there's a way of dealing with things that doesn't make you come across as the doofus atheist who ruins it for everybody.
Yeah, so that's the clip. I recommend that you check the full one out.
And it's coming out in 2014.
Well, that's good. I'll make sure that it gets a full release in cinemas over here. I'm sure Hoyts and Village will be more than happy to
I'm pretty sure
invest.
Planet Shakers will be all over it.
I'm hoping it gives Xena enough time to kick Hercules' ass for being in that show. Jeez.
So moving on to news for this episode. Well, we've got two proper news items. Sarah's going to be talking about DNA and graphene and various awesome like
bio-nanotechnology,
xenobiotic stuff. It's not
futures.
I just like that word.
Yes.
And I'm going to be talking about DNA as well, but in a more of a fossilized DNA. I'm going to link it to Jurassic Park, even though it's not quite there, but it's very cool. Very cool stuff. But I think first we might talk to Alistair about what he's been doing at NASA for 3 months, because that sounds absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
I mean, it's NASA and things.
Yeah. For the more perceptive of you, you probably realize I've dropped off the planet when it comes to the podcast.
Well, if they didn't realize that,
yeah.
Then, yeah, very interesting.
I've been being studying at uni, and I've been doing quite a lot of things. I now have just started my PhD, so I'm about 2 months into that. But the more interesting thing recently is I applied to go to the Lunar Planetary Institute. I got knocked back a couple of times, and then I get this email while I'm lying in bed one morning saying, congratulations, you're going to Houston and working at NASA for 2.5 months. So that was really awesome. About the same time, I also was in the running for the Australian Space Prize, which meant I would have been going to NASA Ames rather than NASA JSC, but I only got second place in that. So I didn't go to that, so I managed to get to NASA JSC. So basically what it did is part of the Lunar Planetary Institute, which was set up shortly after the moon missions, to process all the image, get a bunch of interns over and process all the images and data and everything coming back from the Apollo missions. And so that was the first Lunar Planetary Institute. And since then, it's had a hell of a lot of big names in the community, such as David Draper, Chris McKay, Dave McKay, who are the principal scientists for and against the Mars meteorite about 15 years ago, 20 years ago now, which they thought used to have the alien life from Mars in.
Yeah.
So they were both for and against that. They're brothers, so that would have made for an interesting Christmas table.
You thought Christmas with a C was bad.
Yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah, that would have been... I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that. And many other scientists. It's real principal scientists in the planetary sciences field. So half of us were separated. Some of us were at the Lunar Planetary Institute, and then half of us got to actually work at NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. So that's where I was. I was actually in a Building 31, which is the Astro Materials Research and Exploration Science Directorate, or ARES for short. And this is the coolest building on the face of the planet. It is the place where the lunar rocks are stored. It's the place where half the Antarctic meteorites are stored, including that meteorite from Mars, which has all the beasties in it, or they think has the beasties in it, I should really say.
Yeah, well.
Everything's still out on that one. And it also has the place that has little pieces of Hayabusa. You may remember the Japanese JAXA did pieces that landed in the Nullarbor that we picked up. So NASA has some of those. It also has the Stardust experiments. These are particles which are so small we can't even accurately measure how old they are. But from the orientation they came from and how deeply they penetrated into the aerogel, we can tell that they're interstellar dust particles.
Yeah, cool.
So theoretically, they could even be older than the solar system, like 7 billion years. We just don't know. So they're very, very cool. Analytical techniques are getting better, so like TIMS and SIMS and things like that. So one day we might know. Yeah, they also have old space hardware in there as well. So the Surveyor 3 camera, which they brought back from on the Apollo 12 missions, that was there as well. So lots of really cool things in this small, tiny building.
Do they have the set where they fake the moon landings?
No.
Oh.
No, they don't, unfortunately. But what
that got sold
do.
To a private bidder. Got them a lot of money, enough money to actually go to the moon properly. So it swings and roundabouts.
Thank you, Clive Palmer.
Conspiracies within conspiracies. Keep
well,
going.
There was. It's funny you should bring up the moon rocks, because we actually got to see them. All these things we got to see, and some of us were even lucky enough to do projects on them. I was doing projects on a meteorite, a carbonaceous meteorite called Allende, and which I'll talk about in a little bit, but. One of my intern colleagues, he was working on the some samples from the moon rocks. And you can, as a geologist, you can really see that they're different. Like, for instance, basalt, for those who don't know, especially scoria basalt, it comes out of a volcano and it's kind of vesicly. It looks like bread, but black. But usually on Earth, all the vesicles and everything is nice, quite sharp. But on the moon, because they've had micrometeorite impacts for like the last 4.5 billion years, these have been smoothed over. So all the holes are rather smooth. And when you look at it, it's got a glassy sheen on it. That's because of all the melt impact that has actually covered it over the years. And even some of the breccias rocks there has little bits of this, what we call patina, this melt stuff in there. When you look at this melt, like really, really closely, and an SEM microscope, you have what's called nanophase iron. So an impact when it hits silicates, when it hits the ground, is an incredibly energetic event, especially because we're talking about 16, 18 kilometers per second. These are the velocities you need to do what I'm about to describe. It is an incredibly reducing environment, which means it will take a silicate, it will strip all the oxygen, strip all the silica off, and just leave the metal. And that metal will actually smelt out of that into metal droplets. And we can't even simulate 16 to 18 kilometers per second. We can get up to around about 12, 13, but to get to these velocities, we can't simulate it. And
need to get the Mythbusters involved, yeah. I think.
And they're really beautiful things. You see all these stuff. The project I was doing, I was looking at a meteorite, and usually meteorites are quite small, so you don't really get to see much structure in them. But this collector was kind enough to lend his sample to NASA, and it's like as big as a 15-inch laptop, a Mac laptop. It is
so 15
huge.
Inches.
Yes. No, but it's not exact. It's not square. It's more rectangular. So it looks like a 15-inch. It's massive for a stony meteorite. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what you could see all these mineral alignments with these things called calcium aluminium rich inclusions, and these are the oldest solids in the solar system. So when the sun was new and everything was warm and everything was condensing, these were the first things to condense out. And we're seeing them aligned, which is interesting because in geology, that usually employs mountain building processes. But asteroids are quite small. You don't get that on those sort of things. Or the planetesimals, the 100-kilometer bodies which these things originally came from, we don't get that. So they could only really be formed by how they landed or impacts or things like that. So that's quite interesting.
Very fascinating. Mm. Yeah. So did you go there to do research yourself, or is it more of a trip to find out what they're doing?
Well, it's a trip you get invited to come on to it, and you get to do research. You get teamed up with a NASA scientist or an LPI scientist, and it's normally open to undergrads. So it's a way to get undergrads and get them exposed to what a real taste of research is like. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much the equivalent of an honors thesis crammed into around about 2 months. So whoever is listening to this who's done honours will know what it's like.
They're really scared hearing that right now.
Yeah, but they get to go to
in 2 months.
I mean, NASA.
But the glad
in a very
thing is,
intellectually intimidating environment.
What was really interesting was because I've done honours, doing it in 2 months, it was okay, but it was still very stressful. Like, for instance, we had to do a defence. And we had to do a defense in front of half of Ares. So you had all these NASA investigators come in that are working on the Curiosity probe, working on design references for La Lady, which was just launched. People doing stuff for LRO, people designing the sample return mission OSIRIS-REx. So you have all these people come in and go, yes, tell us how we've been wrong for 30 years.
Yes, young sir.
And it's like...
Very interesting.
I gave a 20-minute talk and I had to give like a 45-minute defense and I felt terrible.
With real swords and just...
Yeah, it was pretty much a real sword.
I would have just said, I haven't got anything to say, but can I get all your autographs? Because that would be cool.
Well, that's 45 minutes right there. Done.
But it was really good. Defenses and things like that are kind of what you acquired. It was nasty, and you always feel bad. But in the end, you feel really good because everyone afterwards come up and go, well, now that we've intellectually hurt you,
cupcakes.
Pretty good. Cupcakes. Yeah, pretty
much. You rock. Well done, you.
Awesome.
So
well,
great.
Yeah, you know, ex-podcast people go in places like NASA. It's good to see.
What was really interesting is that I found out I was the only Australian to go on it.
Ever.
to LPI.
Oh, okay.
On the Lunar Planetary Institute. I guess the trick is for people who are interested in space science and studying anything kind of related at uni is there are a lot of opportunities out there for foreign nationals to get into NASA, not as nearly as many as for nationals, because they have things such as like co-op programs and they have a lot more actual official NASA internships, not doing stuff with the Lunar Planetary Institute.
Yeah, so if you're a uni student or a high school student interested in that sort of stuff, you could go to NASA.
Yeah, potentially. Definitely. Start applying if you're in your second year. Start applying third year, because you'll probably get knocked back a couple of times like I did. But it's an amazing experience. I saw Buzz Aldrin.
Punched you in the face. It was a very authentic experience.
I met Dr. Stan Love, who's an astronaut. I met the Australian astronaut, Andy Thomas. Got to see all these moon rocks. Got to go into old mission control, see some of the spaceship mock-ups. It was an opportunity of a lifetime. It was fantastic.
But I got to see a real-life seal with Dr. Pamela Gay in the bay at Wellington with gold at the New Zealand Skeptics Convention. And I win.
And there was psychic.
And there was a psychic too. What else did I do? And I saw Amanda Palmer live. There we go.
Hey, she's from outer space. Whoa.
I win. No, seriously, dude, that just
that
absolutely
is
rocks.
Awesome. Yeah.
That is really rocks. That's phenomenal. NASA. Man, that is brilliant.
Awesome. Well, what I'm about to talk about does not compete with that. But maybe it does.
I don't know.
But
it has to do with rocks.
Is it to do with seals?
No, it's nothing to do with seals. I wish it was to do with seal.
Oh.
Because I quite like the song Kiss from a Rose.
Oh.
But,
did you know that he has systemic lupus erythematosus?
Oh, really? Did you know that... I was going to quote a lyric. I can't remember.
We've embarrassed him by revealing
No. I'm embarrassed by not remembering the lyrics to Kiss from a Rose. whatever. I get hung up on that. So I saw this awesome paper today. I couldn't go past talking about it on the show.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to say that it's like Jurassic Park, but that's kind of throwing things... it's implying some things that aren't true.
Cart horse.
Yeah, so... in Jurassic Park, everybody knows that they have a mosquito that's trapped in amber for millions of years. Good background music. Yeah, I'll continue to talk over that. And so they have this mosquito blood, or blood in a mosquito that's from a dinosaur. They get the DNA, they clone dinosaurs from that, and things happen. And that's sort of... We've talked about this before, but that's not actually... going to happen, really, because DNA degrades too quickly.
Yeah.
This is a real issue, is that DNA is not that stable. It doesn't exist for millions of years. Bacteria like to destroy it. It likes to decay by itself because it's a molecule that is not particularly strong. So it's been this real limit, DNA decaying. We can't actually get DNA sequences from these ancient organisms. But our technology has been improving, and we've improved our methods of how we, extract DNA and then look at it. And published in PNAS, which is my favorite journal, they have found the mitochondrial genome of an ancient cave bear that lived over 300,000 years ago. So that's actually a very significant period of time.
That is
sort of taxonomically speaking, the bear's pretty similar to the bears that exist today, but that's beside the point. It's a cave bear, so I like to think of it as a giant bear that was 30 metres tall and lived in a cave and spoke to humans and gave some advice.
I'm thinking more along the lines of Sharknado, actually. Somebody
no, I was thinking like Totoro or something from... didn't live in a tree, though.
Yes.
Lived in
next,
a cave
next we'll
and
get the
ate
cat
people.
Bus.
We have... the genome, or it's
the mitochondrial
not the proper genome.
Not quite.
We have genetic information from a bear that went extinct 300,000 years ago. So it's not the proper genome, I must say.
Mm.
It's the mitochondrial genome. So
you can't really do too much with it.
Yeah, it's not. So the mitochondrial genome tends to be, at least within mammals,
pretty stable.
Yeah. Just in terms of, it's not that
just
different.
Follows muscle
our line. Mitochondrial genome versus a dog's mitochondrial genome is not particularly different. Mitochondria tend to have a lot of essential genes in their mm-hmm. genome, so, you can't alter them too much. And the reason that you can get the mitochondrial genome is that it's harder to, construct huge chromosomes. And actually, the method they use to get this genome is actually really fascinating. So when we look for DNA samples in nature and you sort of fragment the sample and you have DNA fragments of certain sizes, we often ignore the really small pieces because they're quite, you know, inaccurate when you're putting things together. They can just be noise. But when you're looking at samples from thousands and thousands of years ago that have been degraded quite a bit, usually all you have are the small samples. Yeah. You have like really small fragments, so like 30 nucleotides in size, which is quite small. And so they use this method that sort of optimized their ability to find these, and then they used algorithms to sort of put it together, and they got this genome. So we'll never, I don't think we'll ever have a proper, fully sort of sequenced genome of an organism that's that old. So we won't have even a sort of Ice Age Park sort of scenario where we've got ancient cave bears roaming around.
Yeah, I was about to say, do you want cave bears running around? I
mean, well, they could do an experiment where they replace the mitochondrial genome of like a brown bear with this one, but it wouldn't do anything. It would just be a novelty.
Super energetic bear.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw King Kong down the road recently, and it didn't end up good. I'm trying to imagine a great big bear running around. Going,
or maybe just a normal sized bear, but with sort of cave bear levels of energy.
Yeah.
Sort of which is less, because if they're in a cave, they're just sleeping a lot. Not much goes on in caves, really. So, yeah, this is just a cool methodology thing that I said. And unfortunately, you know, Jurassic Park's not ever really going to be in our grasp. But, you know, you can console yourself if you're a Jurassic Park fan by the fact that the fourth Jurassic Park film, titled Jurassic World, is going to come out in 2015.
Really?
Which has just been announced.
Oh, really?
Very coincidentally, I saw that today. I wasn't looking for that information. But, you know, all I can say is that I hope it has Jeff Goldblum in it.
Jurassic World. Sam, we'll talk about this now.
I'm going to assume, I don't know anything about the plot and I don't think that's been released, but I'm just assuming that it's an entire planet in the future that's made of dinosaurs, like made of dinosaurs.
Okay, so the ground that we walk on.
Yes, it is.
The tectonic plates, the magma. Yeah,
giant dinosaurs, thousands of kilometres long. No, I just hope it's in the future. No,
actually, if that was a completely separate planet and they like expanded the scale of Jurassic Park, so on a planetary scale, that could actually
be
kind
of cool. Or they
convert
a moon of Jupiter or something
into a dinosaur park.
It'd be great for Io, just, you know, burning dinosaurs everywhere and running around, just not surviving very long.
What I would really like to do is, like, when we finally get out in space and we finally find the first aliens, they're actually dinosaurs. They left, like, millions of years ago.
So they didn't go extinct.
No, they left
on the meteorite.
The meteorite, the asteroid that hit us, opened a portal and they fell through. And then for 65 million years, they've been evolving.
Mushrooms and, like, little TikTok bombs and...
Yeah.
Turning into humans.
Exactly. Yeah.
And their king is a, you know...
Is a mushroom.
Is a mushroom. Oh, I was going to say, you know, their king would be Bowser.
Yeah.
Okay,
and
what did you guys...
And that's why the Super Mario movie
lose the older generation?
That's why
the Super Mario Brothers movie was a documentary.
What kind of dumplings were you guys having before we started? Because I never had King of the Mushroom teleporting dinosaurs on another planet who originally got there from outer space travel. What?
Well, clearly you've never seen the documentary Super Mario Brothers from the 80s.
See, this is what happens when I go to New Zealand. I come back and Australia is just completely...
It was a good film.
It was an awesome film. I loved it when I was like six.
Yeah, well, your six-year-old, you had no taste.
Well, I'm glad to see the love of these things have not died. Yeah. So the fact that even now where we hear about a cave dinosaur berry thingy is resurrected. Not world, just the bear.
It's half bear, half dinosaur, that's what I'd like to say.
So we went from bears to talking to Mario.
It's good news. I'm very glad that the science has progressed.
And we should probably get back to DNA because that's what Sarah's talking about.
Yes, I'm also talking about DNA.
Which is... You know, we didn't plan that, but
it's like
whatever.
Wearing the same shirt too.
I'm a DNA person. Yeah. It'd be interesting if Sarah and I wore the same shirt because, you know, we tend not to overlap too much in our wardrobes.
Normally not.
So what's this about?
Just generally the same skirt. But anyway, please keep.
So what's this about DNA and graphene nanotechnology?
All right. So basically, I was having a look and I came across this article, this study, and I think it has a lot of similarities to Jack's in that, well, one, it deals with DNA, but also it kind of deals with the whole thing that, I mean, DNA is such an amazing concept, molecule, whatever you want to call it, in that it's basically an organic way of containing information. And we have talked about this previously on podcasts that I've been on where some people have succeeded in encrypting sort of information on this computer information by converting the binary code into DNA nucleotides and then storing information on DNA and then then taking it out and basically using it as like a USB. And that blew my mind. Mm-hmm. But kind of there's also been other things that people have been looking at. So people who are more interested in engineering would know that the biggest problem that we have in terms of circuits, that kind of thing, is really we want to go more. We want to get more powerful, but overheating and things like that are preventing things from getting smaller and faster. So something that has emerged is a molecule called graphene, which is basically, like everyone knows graphite's like carbon, and graphene is also carbon, mm-hmm. but it's just arranged in sort of that, not benzene ring, but like...
Hexagonal rings, yeah, all joined together.
Yeah, all joined together in a sheet, a single atom thick sheet. So it's basically a very specific form of carbon that has been postulated and so far appears to be a better semiconductor than silicon. Mm. So it's not quite organic, but, you know, it's basically a form of carbon that could be used to build better semiconductors and advance computing. Anyway, that was a long spiel, but basically there's been a study released in Nature Communications.
Oh, not
PNAS. called Direct Growth of Aligned Graphitic Nanoribbons from a DNA Template by Chemical Vapor Deposition, which is basically saying that because graphene is a very difficult molecule to create, because you have to obviously work on a nanoscale.
But isn't... Because graphene is just like the single layer thick of graphite, right? Why can't they just get a pencil and draw really faint lines?
You know one way how they actually discovered it in nature, actually? It's just not purely synthetic. There's actually ways you can discover it in nature.
Oh, please.
What it is when you have a candle, what you do, you have... you can put... you know, when the candle comes up and... if you hold, I think it was a plastic or like a CD or plastic over it, the smoke and the heat from that actually from a candle from the wax is actually graphene. Ends up there.
Oh. Okay. Cool. So instead of using candles, what they've done is they've taken DNA, and DNA contains carbon, obviously, because it's got a carbon skeleton. And they basically come up with this process where they attach copper salt onto DNA strands and expose it to methane gas and heat it. And it's basically this whole process where it refines the DNA so that the only thing that's left behind is the carbon skeleton.
Yeah, it's like when you accidentally burn sugar, what you're doing, like that black-brown stuff that's left over is just the carbon in the sugar sort of being left behind and all everything else sort of disappearing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And because of the structure of DNA, it's already sort of in a similar state. Basically, by exposing DNA to this process, you end up with very, very thin ribbons of graphene that are left behind. And they're, you know, basically, so now that they've got this process of being able to do it, they're going to put them into semiconductors and see if they can be used in computing.
Does this mean that we have a new potential post-apocalyptic scenario where computers and robots take over and they start using humans for our DNA
to make
the graphene for their computer chips? This is going to turn into mushroom men again. I'm going to start scowling.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like the Matrix where they start, you know, they get us to eat copper and then they throw us in an incinerator with methane.
And they harvest us for our
For our delicious graphene.
This is
actually the best way to do it would be to actually grow a bunch of blueberry bushes and just put copper in the ground because blueberries take up a lot of copper. In the ground.
Okay.
So maybe the robot, I think maybe apocalypse is probably
bacteria
bad
might
for
be slightly better just because bacteria.
I'm trying to imagine selling
like
the
that.
Matrix on the basis of, well, you see, it's all about these blueberry bushes.
they become sentient. And
hey, I think Keanu Reeves would be great as a blueberry bush. He's got exactly the same kind of acting skills.
You can just imagine like this Terminator thing was walking by, move away, human, I need to get to the blueberry bush.
Yes. So DNA is a very versatile molecule that can be used to store electronic information and also to build the computer chips of the future.
Mm. Yeah, I just can't get past that scenario where we all
I just find it pretty cool that DNA strands can be turned into these graphene things for...
Well, it could probably be most molecules. It's just that DNA is already in that linear structure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it, not many molecules are actually that long, really. That, or well, I guess you can make them that long, but DNA sort of, in a sense, makes itself. Mm. So you just make a lot of bacteria, you know, in a flask and then just... do that and extract the DNA. Actually, that's what I'm doing at the moment with my flies. I'm crushing the flies up and extracting their DNA. It's pretty cool, really. I get to put get flies in tubes with little glass beads and then put it in a machine that shakes it really fast and I just destroy the entire fly. I homogenize the fly, quote unquote. It's pretty brutal. I do, like, you know, anesthetize them first by putting them in the freezer so that they it's in 5 seconds they're frozen solid. You know, surface area to volume ratio.
If Jack you, if is you put laughing
a,
about
if you
this,
put a person in the freezer, they don't freeze in 5 seconds, let me tell you.
And
that.
And you're gonna have to have a lot of little balls.
And they're
to, like,
really
break
hard to homogenize.
Yeah, it's hard to homogenize a person. Just tell someone that works in a funeral home.
That's it. I'm taking a photo of you and putting it up on Twitter. This is Jack laughing about freezing flies.
About fruit fly genocide.
Aww. Okay.
Don't worry, it was only 15 flies. actually, 30. I'm a monster.
Oh, Jack.
I kill more flies just by breeding them, you know. Mm. I let the adults die in the vials and then their babies eat. Their children eat them.
It's
okay?
Concentration camp, like, this conditions
is,
well, here.
This is why I don't come to Melbourne very often. Hearing about Jack's research,
I use CO2,
makes me
but...
cry.
The fly in the striped pajamas. No.
Do you know that the kid, the boy in the boy in the striped pajamas, is named Jack Scanlon? So full circle.
I think we should be talking about Jack's list.
Yeah. Scanlon's list.
Scanlon's list.
Doesn't that put me on the other side of the?
You're a double
little
Asian.
Fly railway with little tubes. Quick flies, run, get out.
Burrowing through the cotton.
Yeah.
So that took a turn for the Nazi.
That got dark.
Anyway.
Okay, we should probably move on to Jargonauts. And this is not particularly a scientific word. I guess it is a little bit. But it's a very context-relevant word. And that is, maybe we'll get Kylie to talk about it, since she's our resident sort of quote-unquote proper skeptic that's been doing lots of skeptical stuff. So what's our word for this week?
Yes, but I don't have as many science degrees or science experience as everybody in the room, so that certainly puts me in
three
my
gets one, so potentially, yeah.
We're no longer pseudo.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
I am the pseudo here. I'm the pseudo here. Okay, so which one do you want to talk about? Triskaidekaphobia, which is coming up this Friday.
Then why is it coming up this Friday?
Friday the 13th.
What does that mean?
It means fear of Friday the 13th.
Because Triskaideka means, you know, 13, right?
So, yeah. Can you say that word again slowly so everyone can hear it? Because I don't think I caught that word.
Yeah. So there's Triskaidekaphobia.
I think the last time I heard Triskaideka was probably in my organics chemistry class.
Yeah. Triskaidekaline.
Everyone practice together. Trisk.
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 Car.
Deck. Phobia.
Triskaidekaphobia.
What is
well
phobia?
Done. Fear of Friday the 13th. And I remember reading about paratrekker triskaidekaphobia.
So is that fear of the paranormal occurring on Friday the 13th?
No, paratrekker
triskaidekaphobia.
It's a nice guess. Apparently paratrekker triskaidekaphobia, which I practiced several times in order to make sure I could say it on a television show, and then they didn't ask me about it.
Time wasted.
Yeah, is more about fear of it occurring in several different places throughout the year, because it's not just once a year, apparently it's several times.
Actually, the way that the calendar is structured mean that Friday is the most likely day of the week to fall on the 13th.
Mm. It's a conspiracy by Julius Caesar or whoever did the calendar. I don't know, what was it, Gregorian
months? Gregorian plus Julius Caesar.
We need to do more research before we do this one.
Essentially.
Yeah. But we were also talking about one, which is another one, was triophobia, which is a fear of a repetitive pattern, apparently, but it can also mean the fear of little dots.
Mm.
Or little holes.
I came across
in
this
flesh.
In my... That's the whole point of it, really, apparently. I came across this while I was doing research and also while I was on psych. Yeah. And it's a very, very common... form of, it's not really a phobia, it's a common form of causing people
unease
and discomfort.
Icking them out.
Technical term is
Yeah, making it's malaise. Very. Yeah. Basically, it's where you see, if you've ever looked at like a fence or like a little piece of metal that has holes in it, repetitive holes, and then you kind of zoom out from it, at a certain point, it just starts to weird you out.
This sounds like a David Lynch movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't
understand.
That
sort of stuff.
This is an issue for me.
Everything's an issue for you.
And so people have been research into this recently. It was only accepted by Wikipedia recently, I think.
Well, that's the gold standard, right?
I thought you were going to say like
they were holding out. Yes, we got Wikipedia.
That's it.
Internet. It's real.
I'm going to put Jack in Wikipedia, making a
The Young Australian Skeptics is on Wikipedia.
Good. Anyway,
Jack entry.
And we didn't exist before then. So
I'm glad
we are.
Yeah. Basically, the reason that so many people feel unease when they see this, and if anybody does feel this, feel free to shout us something, a line. it's because there are things in nature that have repetitive dots or repetitive holes in them. And most of the things that have repetitive holes in them are either rotting or poisonous. So if you look at sort of a lot of poisonous animals, they also will have these sort of repetitive patterns on them. Basically the whole concept behind it, the theory behind it is that we have retained on some level the unease that certain animals feel when seeing, you know, poison arrow frogs or whatever, that
Reds
is telling us,
oranges.
No, don't touch this. This is poisonous and it will kill you. Yeah.
Do you think this is more of an issue for people that are non-religious? Because, you know, they don't like holy things. Whoa! I'm here since Thursday until Thursday. You were going to say something before I had to interrupt you for that.
It's an intense fear of holy things.
Why is everyone still listening to us?
Because
I
want to learn more about
I ask that every week.
So could you repeat that word for us?
Triophobia.
Triophobia.
It's one of the Skeptics Guide to the Universe presenters. He was... because he's American, he asked us the question because he hates spiders and he was looking up all these things because he was really afraid of Australian...
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Stuff. And one of his first questions was like, seriously, how are you all not dead yet?
Because we're immune to the venom? I mean...
We've been here so long.
We have triophobia.
We get bitten five times every night.
We just rub Vegemite on it. It's all good.
We have triophobia. We know that we don't touch the things.
Vegemite
the patterns
is
all
just...
You know that the natural
predators
of all those dangerous spiders is the koala bear, so, you know...
Yeah, I mean, that's how you stop drop bears. You put a little bit of Vegemite behind your ears.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's really... It's a government initiative that was started in the 40s. People don't really know this very well, but Vegemite is actually homogenized spiders, and we are being exposed to an oral vaccine.
And unfortunately, our Prime Minister in the 60s, Harold Holt, succumbed to that. He actually ate Vegemite before going swimming, and he suffered the consequences.
Yes. Was that 30 minutes before swimming?
Well, you know, we never know.
Medically, they say that you shouldn't consume Vegemite before going swimming for at least 12 hours.
Because you just want to drink all of the water.
I love Vegemite.
Even if it is salty water.
Oh. Yeah.
I do know one thing. I got to show this to the New Zealanders because, of course, the drop bear joke came up, as you do, with people from overseas. If you go, I believe it's the National Australian Museum website, they have a very factual-looking page about the drop bear.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
The range distribution is a drop bear face. Australia.
It's so cute. Yeah. And it's great for showing kids in terms of demonstrating, you know, internet literacy and critical thinking because you say, okay, let's have a look at this. It's an official-looking site. This is what it says about what do we know, kids? How would we do? Do we just trust one source, even if it is a national museum? And then we talk about it in class. And how would you find it?
I'd like to continue the illusion that drop bear is real, but people actually listen to this show for real information. So,
have you guys heard of hoop snakes?
No.
Oh, no, they're real.
They are real.
They are terrifying.
Yeah. Basically, what happens is when they see people walking down a gully, they grab hold of their own tail with their mouth and then they roll down.
It's like a bicycle wheel.
Yeah.
And everyone knows how crazy they are.
This is true.
I actually have...
Have you come across also sand possums?
No.
You wouldn't.
You wouldn't, would you? Would you, Jack? Sand possums are really bad. You find them mainly in deserts. Mm. Like, basically, they come out at night when when you're sitting in your tent or by the fire. Basically, they just they bury under the ground, kind of like a mole, and then they come up and they scare you. Same things with fire spiders. Fire spiders is like when you're sitting around a fire, you'll notice that these spiders come up from behind you and they go because they're attracted towards the firelight. So you call them fire spiders. You don't want to get bitten by them. You might lose a leg.
So, returning to the factual content of our program.
Yeah, so, you know, drop bears aren't real, but everything else that Alistair just said is real. Mm. So it's never come to Australia.
Including mushroom you will men die. Who rule the outer space with their teleporting
space. And Vegemite isn't actually homogenized spiders.
Yeah. Do you know that people in Australia die every day?
Oh, my God.
It's a very dangerous place to live.
Oh, my God. I'm choking on the horror of it all.
Okay, so we have a question of the week that we asked last week. As with most weeks, we have a question of the week. And that question last week was, what is the biggest challenge facing the Australian sceptical community?
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Do you want to state your opinion?
The Liberal government.
Oh, zing. Oh, that's political and topical.
Stop sounding so enthusiastic.
Yeah.
No, I honestly think that.
Really?
Okay, it's not the biggest, but it's probably the most pertinent at the moment. Like, it's like something that's just popped up and, like, went, oh, no. It's a government that is probably going to be a lot more right-wing, less investing in research, in sort of science education / education.
It's quite interesting. If you have a look at the reports, they've already said that they're going to cut Australian Council of Research funding by $103 million. And they also want to set themselves up as arbiters on research because they're unsatisfied with a lot of the social arts getting research, which is you can't set things up politically because this is also the same government which is completely hostile to climate change. We can see that because
amazingly hostile
because they're getting rid of the carbon tax and replacing it with nothing. Oh, I'm sorry, not nothing. $450 million for a pen and paper green army.
I don't know if that's particularly a challenge towards the sceptical community as such.
I think,
and it's not what I was saying about challenge was. What is an issue they have to deal with? So I don't think the sceptical community can do anything about the Liberal government that we elected.
I think in some cases, as the debate of climate change will come back up, the sceptical community will be dragged back once again, as with the Australian government, Australian people, into is climate change real? Is it really happening? Are humans causing it? And we're just going to have to go through this whole cycle again of going, yes, it's real. Yes, the science says this. No, they're not sceptics, they're deniers. No, we're not affiliated with them.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of sceptics who consider themselves sceptics who are climate change denialists, and I think that's a problem, and I think that, shouldn't be publishing their works and shouldn't be encouraging them.
I think that is a big thing. Like, they require, for some reason, a larger body of evidence. I have noticed that for a lot of people who are climate change denialists, they come from a lot of the older crowd, in some cases, a lot of the older scientific crowd, which you can kind of understand if you understand the history of climate change and the fact that if you go back in the 70s and 80s, it was kind of fringe. But now it is definitely no longer fringe. It's like, I don't know what would be a modern day example, but
immunisation. Although that was a long time ago.
Yeah, immunisation. We still have people that, for some reason, don't believe that, mainly because
that was proven back when we gave people blood from cows with smallpox.
We also have other new things which are coming up, things such as coal seam gas. There's a lot of a lot of dodgy science on both sides of this issue, which is not getting discussed. And a lot of people on both sides are trying to drag it one way or the other into fantasy land.
Hmm.
And that's something which we have to get educated on, which I think is important, especially because that is becoming quite a large issue.
So we have some answers from the people that listen to this show, and that's usually what this segment is about. We want to hear what our audience thinks about a particular topic. So Jason is not the Jason that you're probably thinking of is not Jason Ball, who used to be on the show, another Jason. He says the biggest challenge for Australian scepticism in the future is not bitching and arguing with itself the entire time. Yeah. This also applies to the global sceptical and atheist communities. That's a good thing.
It's a very good thing to say.
A lot of
it's
personal
a bit,
things going on sometimes.
Yeah.
Can distract from actually doing things that matter.
Well, some of it does matter. I mean, things like sexism, abuse, things like lack of diversity, these are things that we should stand up and say something about. And I think it's absolutely right that we should. But, when I found myself recently on Twitter saying to people I consider my friends, please stop doing this. I like you all. This is getting us nowhere and I don't want to see you doing this to each other, please. That is an example of where I find myself.
That's something.
Yeah, the personal stuff that gets in the way of doing. If there's an issue within the community, you know, like there's not enough representations of non-white, non-male.
Yeah, or people getting physically attacked or people having to go to the police due to being hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, there's issues there. But if it's like just personal sort of in-group stuff, that is...
It also comes across as incredibly unprofessional and it gives a lot of ammunition to our detractors.
Yeah, it really does.
So I agree. Probably not the way that Jason has phrased it, but, yeah, I definitely agree that Jason has a point there. Sometimes it can really get you down, especially if... Like many modern skeptics, and a skeptic like myself who's in a very isolated part of the world, your main access to skepticism is via online means. Mm. And if you see the online community just imploding upon each other, it can be incredibly depressing.
There are so many camps now. It's huge.
Here at the Pseudoscientists, we do not formally align ourselves with any of these camps.
We just think Jack's awesome. So yes,
it is a cult of personality.
Unless he's a sand possum, Jack's not a sand possum.
Ricky says the biggest challenge is communicating outside ourselves. It's all very well educating each other. It's important even. But the people who really need to hear the messages that we have aren't actually getting those messages.
It's interesting. I remember the Vic Skeptics used to consider themselves a lobby group. And they did quite a lot of outreach to younger kids and stuff like that. Things have changed, as in different social presses have changed, different technology mediums have changed. And it's all one thing to preach to the choir. Everyone likes preaching to the choir. Everyone likes having people agree with them. But we also need to go out and do a lot more activism with people who don't know these things.
That's the point. If you have a movement, unless it's a movement founded on the principle of, this is a special group for special people, there's no reason, that should be your main focus, is to get the message out there, really. That is the point, in a way.
Especially
since skepticism isn't a conclusion, it's a way of looking at the world. So the more people that are actually applying that method and investigating things, you know, that's what it's all about.
I love the way that the New Zealand skeptics, for example, I was challenged by Vicky Hyde on the stage saying, okay, well, how do you know that this is going to reach beyond your typical... I mean, I do a podcast, same as you. How do I know it's going to reach beyond? And that was a massive challenge for me, and I thought, I'm going to have to start working on this more often. But we see science communication groups do this all the time. How do you assess your impact? How do you know that you're reaching beyond getting into new arenas and so forth? Yeah, getting a bit creative.
And if you write a blog about science, how do you know that it's not just other science communicators that are reading that blog?
It's not only that, right? It's like all three of us.
There's three people in the room.
Kylie is a ghost.
So we'll have science friends, science family, and
science family.
You know, so we're really kind of internal. But when I see people like Tim Minchin, who is not a scientist,
but he's a skeptic,
and
he has a degree in psychology, doesn't he?
No, Tim Minchin's dad is a doctor in the hometown of Perth. However, he graduated from university with an arts degree and went on to Whopper in order to do a diploma in jazz. Welcome to
diploma
knowledge about
in
blokes.
Jazz.
And there was another skeptic.
Welcome
I know
to Bloke Talk.
Yeah.
You're listening
but
to your
yeah,
host,
definitely
Bruce
an arts
Marks.
Background, which
and
I think is really refreshing.
Fantastic. And he just reaches way more people.
Yeah,
than
he just has such a different, not perspective, well, it's the same, but just different reach. I agree. Yeah. Different appeal.
He has piano skills.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's the difference.
And same with people like Robin Ince, who teams up with Brian Cox and does these amazing shows, and he quite openly admits, hey, I'm a comedian, but I'm going to do tours like carols for godless people and outreach science shows in order to touch base with that.
Very effective.
Why not? Yeah.
So that's definitely another thing that Australian skepticism needs to do. So our last little contribution comes from James, and he says, in a nutshell, as your picture suggests, so I put a picture up and it's all sort of like the Australian skeptical like group at the top that, you know, that run the Australian Skeptics. As the picture suggests, I'm not sure if this was deliberate or not, diversity within the skeptical movement and sister movements like atheism is still a problem. There is still very much an overrepresentation of older white males. I think we need to figure out as a community why we have not been more successful in reaching out to certain demographics and try harder to ensure that our message about the importance of science and critical thinking is presented in a manner relevant and accessible to all. So that sort of pretty much sums up that. That is really an important issue. You know, you want to get your message out there, but you don't necessarily want to go to, okay, well, these are all white males, maybe middle-aged to older white males. Let's preach to more middle-aged, older white males. That'll definitely get more community outreach there. You need to appeal to everybody and work out what works and what doesn't.
I think that's one of the reasons why we actually started the Young Australian Skeptics.
That is the reason really.
Is because we wanted to... We're passionate about skepticism and science and stuff like that. And we saw these great organisations which were full of, well, old white men. And we could see them almost about to go extinct. And we were like,
well,
okay.
Well, it wasn't that quite that dramatic, but it's a nice story.
But we wanted
Jurassic
to...
Park.
So...
Can we get their DNA? Can we?
No, Richard Attenborough, stand back.
So yeah, we wanted to reach out to a younger audience, and yeah,
because you know if you don't reach out to a younger audience, then you soon don't have an audience. Because if you know you have a show for 50 years, then your audience dies. That's an extreme scenario. But you know, in 30
years, we're still podcasting in 50 years, man.
Mind casting. Into the void of the between
the young,
planets.
They're not so young anymore.
We see, we've gone back.
The young
pseudonauts. We've gone back to psychics now.
Yeah. Space.
Yeah, but I mean, I think about two recent examples. Warren Bonnet, who runs in Big and Books, and his Australian Book of Atheism, where he tried really hard to get a diverse amount of people to contribute the book. And I hope he continues to do another one. The Global Atheist Convention, which the last one did have.
A very good cross-section of the Australian community.
A very good cross-section of the Australian community, but they nearly had the four horsemen up on the stage, and it was going to be the five horsemen until Christopher Hitchens died, but Ayaan Hirsi Ali took the stage in order to fill the gap that was sadly missing by Christopher Hitchens. I think all of these examples lead the way in terms of, yes, it can be done. The group No Chicks, No Excuses was started after Jane Caro, Leslie Canold, and... lady comedian from Melbourne. She's awesome. Jack's pulling faces.
There's a lot of those. And it's good that there's a lot.
Jack's like, where do I start?
But so many female comedians in Melbourne.
Sorry.
Which is, you know, there's lots of female comedians
everywhere.
I will
remember her as I'm driving home and I go, damn, should have mentioned it. But yeah,
it's not Catherine Devney, is it?
Catherine Devney, thank you.
The only one in Melbourne.
Sorry. I was looking at you waving my fingers and making you sad. I'm sorry. But yeah, they started a group called No Chicks, No Excuses after they...
She'd be loving the fact that Abbott's Prime Minister.
Oh, yes.
She would.
But yeah, they started a group in order to see if they can encourage more diversity on stages everywhere and allow everyone to put their name forward. And I know, I mean, I am an older generation person sitting here right now. I'm hardly young, and even though I want to be supportive, I have to take a step back and say, no, sorry, put other people's names forward, put other people as suggestions for conferences. That's something I always do and I think everyone should do. I look around at that the world, and certainly in terms of scepticism, and say to myself, well, we can all play our part in encouraging the diversity. If you can't find a person the first time, keep on asking. If you notice that conferences...
There's always going to be somebody there.
If a conference has started up and they're just starting to put out the call for speakers, put forward names, put forward ideas, and try to be positive about it. Think to yourself, okay, I'm going to think outside the box here and there, and you know, give other people a chance. I know that as
think
an older generation,
the box hill.
Think outside the box. As an older generation, I know that, you know, passing on the torch and sort of going, yes, it's your turn now. When I feel that I still have so much more to give, it's a little difficult, but you know, God, it's healthier. I mean, Christ, it's great to be able to see something new and changing and diverse, and that, I think, helps encourage a new and diverse changing progress of skepticism.
Awesome.
Definitely.
There you go. And now I shall go into my box in the corner, having passed on the torch in order to... No, you can't have it! It's mine! It's mine! No, it's mine! I've still got blood left in me! Don't put me in amber, please, Richard Attenborough. Please, I don't want to be a little bug.
Need some lysine in you.
Let me out! Let me out!
So, and next week's question is inspired by our new liberal overlords and the fact that they may be changing a few rules when it comes to science funding in this country. And we want to have a bit of a think. So if you had to make a choice as a governmental person or just as yourself with new fascistic dictator powers over Australia or the entire world, which branch of science research would you want to get the least amount of funding? So you have to make a choice.
Yeah.
You have to cut a limb off the many-limbed tree that is the science. Tree of knowledge, science, whatever
name
metaphor I'm trying to say.
Name something and send your hate mail in.
Yeah, so, you know.
Let's be a bit controversial here, guys.
Yeah, so just choose something.
I still remember that picture on Love Science. It was a physics cat prefers to sit on something soft, and there's this picture of a cat sitting on a biology textbook.
Yeah.
I'll stab that cat in the face.
Oh, God.
Okay, so if you have...
Whatever field Jack is studying is the field that I wouldn't fund.
I'm going to reduce funding to cat cancer.
Inhumane.
I want every cat to get cancer. And you can quote me on that. No. So we want your opinions.
I can just imagine 20 years from now when he's going...
I want every cat to have cancer.
I have a complaint. I have a complaint on behalf of Mr. Muffy.
I so want to quote that 20 years from now. I don't know.
You can just imagine, like, you know, Jack, like, I don't know, what would you be doing?
In a Dr. Evil submarine with my cat cancer ray.
It'll have a little quote. I want every cat to have cancer.
And that's why I can't run for...
Professor Jack Scanlon, you know, head of something.
I like that. You were going to be president of the Academy of Sciences.
Yeah.
You were.
Mr. Mufti says no.
Okay, so if you have an opinion on that question, then send it in.
I have an opinion. I think we'll talk about it next week.
And other than that, I think there's just a couple of things to mention. So, you know, this month we've got our perspectives on Australian skepticism chugging along. The last post that happened between this episode and last episode was an interview with Warren Bonnet at Inbigan Books. So that's a fascinating look at a bookstore in Melbourne that is very pro-science, very pro-scepticism, and is doing quite well for itself. It's a great place. If you've been there and you live in Melbourne, then what is your excuse? You have no excuse. Go there. So check that out. That's by Jonathan Meddings. Also, again, you can send in audio feedback or audio responses to our question of the week via Audio Boo, which is, you know, up to 3 minutes of audio. Please make it around 30 seconds. Otherwise, I will make you a racist in my editing. And I'm very good at that.
I'm going to send you my cat's meow. I'm going to send that to you.
And also, if you're a young person in Melbourne and you want to get involved in the new podcast project that I'm doing, which is Unfiltered Thoughts, and you want to have a chat with me about science over a coffee, then let me know. Send your details in and I'll get in touch. Okay, so we're basically at the end of the show. As we always do at the end of the show, we have to talk about a couple of things. And one of these is the Skeptical Blog Anthology. Now, we're joined in the studio by the person that edited this for us. And
I'm busy taking a photo of myself for the Twitter. This is me. This is me smiling about me. Oh, my God, I actually look decent. What the hell?
Well,
sorry, yes.
The power of the selfie.
Yeah.
So the Skeptical Blog Anthology is one way you can monetarily support the show. It was put together by our good friend Kylie Sturgis, who is in the studio, and it's a collection of essays and online articles that a lot of famous people in the skeptical community
put together.
I don't
look as awesome as Sarah does in this photo. I think I shall edit her out. Anyway, sorry, yes, you were talking about the other people, were you?
You know, you could take a selfie quietly.
No.
Anyway, so keep talking, Jack.
Yes, yeah, please.
So this is one way to support the show.
Definitely.
Buy a book and you get something in return. You also give money to us and we get some stuff. Also, if you don't want to do that, you can you know, donate via PayPal. youngaosskeptics@gmail.com is our PayPal account. We'll soon have a button up on the site, but until then, you know, go through those channels. If you want to also support the show in a sort of very internet-y social media way, you can let your friends know, and family, of course, know about the show. Send that along. But give us a review or rating on iTunes. That really helps people find out about the show. It's quite good. Also, it gives us feedback about how you think the show is going and whether or not you like it. That's always a good
thing. Bad reviews are okay. Well, we prefer good ones.
Yeah, good ones. Your show's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, no bad ones. I mean, if you have any complaints, then send it via email. Don't use iTunes as the medium. It's just, I do not recommend it. If you want to get in contact with us, we have Facebook pages. We have The Pseudoscientists and also The Young Australian Skeptics. We're on Twitter, Young AUS Skeptic and PseudoSciPod. Our email is youngaosskeptics@gmail.com. If you have any feedback, go through there. If you want to check out our website, which is youngaosskeptics.com, we have a lot of articles popping up all the time on various things, like perspectives on Australian skepticism. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm Jack L. Scanlon. Tom is Lang EM High. Rachel is Rachel MK. Belinda is AUS Tronomer. And Sarah doesn't have Twitter, unfortunately, because she's just behind the curve. She's streets behind.
Face. Sarah, you've got to get on Twitter just so you can check out this funny photo I'm about.
And Kylie, you can check out all her photos from her time on the podcast today at Kylie Sturgis, and also Token Skeptic as well.
Yeah, Token Skeptic is my podcast. As soon as this show's over, I'm running straight back to my hotel in order to get the next episode out. Yeah.
Awesome.
I promise. Oh, I'm so tired.
Hopefully there's some crossover between our shows.
Hell yes. I love your show. Awesome, awesome.
Alistair, is there anything that... Any internet things that people can catch on? I'm not assuming.
Actually, no. I've really tried to get into... I used to have a Twitter, but I kind of just let it...
Well, you better get back on it, because there's a demand. People are clamouring for the Alistair on the old internet, I'm assuming.
Especially with all these NASA tiles, dude. Yeah, you've got to send us photos. You know, at least start up an Instagram and post all the photos.
Start up a Tumblr, Tales from NASA or something, and just make NASA fan fiction or something.
And I'll just sit here with my pictures and my seal... Okay, next to Pamela Gay and feel jealous.
I'll give some photos for the podcast.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Plus
thank
astronaut
you.
Slash fiction. Thank you very much.
That'd be good. But if anyone does want to contact me, just contact through the website and
we'll
if you have any questions about trying to get into NASA. Things like awesome. That.
Definitely.
Cool. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks guys for coming on the show. It's been great having two guests, and also Sarah, of course. Obviously, she's. I don't have to thank her because she's always here. So yes.
Aww.
Yeah, very reliable. Just a pack horse of this vodka. No, that's terrible.
She's wonderful, and she looks great on Twitter. Certainly better than me. God damn it.
Yeah, so thanks, guys, for coming on the show. As always, our intro and outro music is Glorious Feeling by Jollysticks, and Sarah and I will see you next week. Thanks for coming on, and see ya.
Thanks, guys.
So much, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Catch ya.
There's any evidence for proper psychic powers. I said that right. I said
skeptics. Yes, you did.
I thought I might have said as psychics, but good.
welcome to the psychic podcast. This time we're turning over to the other side.
Pseudo psychics.
Oh, that would be fun. Quick, get the URL.